Hello, and welcome to the second episode of Interviews with the Experts, a podcast series in transplantation medicine, as part of Dr. Farah-Raza's project on transplantation medicine, and which has been funded by the Oxford Law Faculty's Internet Fund.
I am Frances Hand. I'm a DPhil in law at Oxford University, and I'm currently examining violence against women in UK maternity wards. I have with me Dr. Julia Reisman. Dr. Reisman is a social anthropologist working on issues around temporality, technology, and materiality in the context of palliative care and transplantation medicine. She is a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Health Professions at the Bern University of Applied Sciences, where she is conducting an ethnographic research on palliative care in Switzerland. And if this wasn't enough, she is also a research associate at the Institute of Social Anthropology at the University of Bern. Thank you so much for joining me today, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
So just to start off, could you please just explain to the layman of the group a bit more about your research?
So my research that I'm invited to talk about today is very much on liver transplants and the experience of waiting while patients kind of undergo while waiting for a liver transplant. And what was initially supposed to be a research project and a PhD project on international travel and kind of transplant tourism from Germany across its borders became very early on after I started conducting my field work. So attending patient meetings, going to clinics, a research that was not as, scandalous or sensational as I was hoped, or my supervisor hoped it might be. But I was very early on got caught by the issue of waiting, because patients I met and people who received the transplant didn't stop talking about the wait list and their waiting experience. And so I was like, okay, people tell you continuously about waiting, maybe that's something to take into account and look closely what it's all about.
That's really interesting. So what specific insights then did you gain from talking to these people?
So like most anthropological research projects, my insights derive basically mostly from the kind of interviews, participant observations, spending time with patients pre and post transplant, with medical professionals, nurses, surgeons, physicians, psychologists, etc. But we also gain insights, we as anthropologists, through literature, engagement with already existing research that's kind of out there. And so my insights became kind of a mesh of both of these things. And the insights I got, if you break it down very generally, is that while waiting seems on a superficial level as something very dull, boring, like a pain in the ass, if you want, so on your way to a transplant and a treatment that you really, really desire, waiting serves a certain purpose, I would say, for patients. And waiting is way more complex and has a lot of dimensions that if you on a first glance are not really aware of. So on the one hand, that waiting is an important experience to kind of prepare patients and also I would say their relative friends, their kind of caretaking network, for the kind of chronic life that unfolds after a patient receives a transplant, but also for the patients themselves to kind of get prepared for the surgery and the kind of very intense shift that comes along with it. And on the other hand, on a more like academic level and researcher focused level, waiting has so many dimensions that kind of blew me away when I started to look more closely. Like waiting has a political dimension, like who is allowed to wait? What are the kind of legal frameworks that allow certain people to like start waiting in the first place, or when does waiting actually begin? Does waiting begin when you put in a wait list, or does waiting begin when you have like first symptoms or when you're diagnosed? So waiting becomes very hard to pin down at some point. It's a as I mentioned, political, legal, like really the regulations, like at what point, what kind of are the criteria that you have to fulfill to be allowed to wait and to be granted access to the wait list. Waiting has very existential dimensions, like waiting between life and death in the case of liver transplants, because unlike with kidney failure, if your liver fails, there's no other treatment like dialysis that you can be put on to kind of sustain your life for a longer period. So for patients with failing livers and who suffer from a very wide range of liver diseases, transplant is more or less the only chance they have if they want to go down that path. Then waiting has also, if you think about clinics and kind of rooms and spaces where waiting unfolds, waiting has a spatial dimension. If you, in clinics, you have waiting rooms. How are they structured? How do people navigate clinical spaces during their waiting time? How accessible are they? How, like for me, one of the also very striking, vivid pictures was all the rows facing the TV. So you have the TV that is more or less center stage there. And I thought, waiting rooms could also be places where people meet, exchange experiences, share, have a conversation with their neighbor. And so usually people in waiting rooms either look at the TV or their phones. So you rarely have this connection with fellow waiters, if you want so.
Yeah, it's like a ready-made support group. Right, of people going through the same thing.
So I had I did like a little self experiment, because my research in clinics was also involved a lot of waiting. So you're waiting for patients to show up. You're waiting for people to be recruited. You're waiting for something to happen. So you're also, if you're doing anthropological research and field work in clinical spaces, but also in other contexts, doing ethnographic research also involves a waiting researcher. So I was sitting in the waiting room and reading like a book, very consciously, not writing, but reading a book also on some transplant thing that was in the news at that moment. And I actually got in a conversation, like a person next to me started a conversation, but very much focused on the fact that nobody tends to read any longer. Just looking at the phone. But waiting, if you think about it, how waiting is structured, ordered, it becomes in the spaces where people wait, also at home, has a spatial dimension. In what I got really interested in is, or like two my aspects. One was a moral one. So there's a lot of morality in while you're waiting, like how you are supposed to wait, mm-hmm. how grateful you are supposed to be also after you receive the transplant. So there's a lot of a moral kind of dimensions to it, and very big dimension to it is a technological one. So how is waiting organized, or how is a wait list organized? How does waiting, the kind of technological back office of the waiting experience, if you want so. So how are organs actually allocated to the people who are waiting? Mm-hmm. And so for me, waiting became very interesting to think about, particularly so because it seems on a first glance boring and not much to unpack there.
I think the idea, I love the irony of you also being someone that has to wait while examining waiting. And then I just wondered off that about some of the ideas about
what makes a good patient when waiting. So some of the ideas about, did you see anything about the perception of fairness? So in terms of who was allocated, and then also sometimes when people were allocated but then weren't able to access that organ and went back onto the waiting list. Did you have any experiences in that area?
There's that's one side to it. So on the one hand, patients, also nurses. So it's not that just patients.
Right. Yeah,
maybe that's even more among medical staff, like who got what kind of organ and who is still waiting among the patients and who isn't. And this is very much, I would say, it's also gendered. It's also very much focused on framed by a moralization of alcoholic diseases. So alcohol abuse is one of the main issues why people develop liver failure. And whilst it is recognized as a disease, the whole issue of self-responsibility becomes very, very tangy there, if you want. So nurses who are like, why is this person receiving a liver, and the very generalized, and the mother of three is still waiting. Yeah. So, but this is more, I would say, the waiting, the moralization during waiting. So this is more like the after waiting, when the allocation already happened. But during waiting, you have discourses also of who's a good patient and who isn't, who's asking too many questions and is kind of bothering like medical staff with another question and coming up with another thing that they want to kind of clarify, and who is more like quietly accepting kind of the obligations they have to fulfill, the information they receive. And so you have I can't say that affects their chances for transplant, but it definitely has an effect on the kind of treatment you receive, the more like interaction, like intersubjective treatment. So whether you're liked as a patient or not, whether you're seen as a difficult patient or not.
Right.
So there's the moral aspect of that. And related to alcohol, there's also a gender dimension there. So there appears to be, like, women are seen in general as those who are more into preventive, medical prevention, who are taking care of their health, not only of their own health, but also of their kin. And when women fail to do so, they're way more punished in a way than men are. Women who kind of start drinking alcohol and kind of lose their kind of control over this, those are the kind of the wordings that are circulating. They receive, they're treated worse by clinical staff, and they suffer due to that. So waiting becomes it's not the same for every patient, depending on, I would say, on the one hand, the medical condition and disease you kind of have in the first place, and the symptoms that are kind of attributed to that, but also depending on your gender and your particular kind of socioeconomic background and how you behave also due to that.
Yeah, that is, I think that's, it's quite similar to my work, actually. I could kind of see some of the things of kind of intersubjective care and the differences. And it's, gendered and probably also racial in some degrees and socioeconomic in some degrees. And it struck a chord for me too. And then linking it back to the public. So one thing I was wondering, if patients knew the benefits of waiting lists and the waiting period, do you think that would assist them in terms of when they finally do access an organ?
I think for people, no, I don't, I'm not sure, to not be that general. I'm not sure, to be honest, because to be aware that the waiting, like, you have to imagine that people on the wait list or people waiting for a liver, they're very often compared to, like, this kind of waiting period is often compared to waiting in the last weeks of pregnancy. So another kind of parallel maybe you have with your research. So the last weeks of pregnancy, when you have to be prepared all the time, could be done. You know, you can get a phone call from a clinic. It's happening now. You need to come now. So in, like, when you're pregnant, this duration is like four weeks. Mm-hmm. But those who wait for liver, this is kind of open-ended, undefined, an undefined, uncertain period of time where you have to be prepared at all times. With the, and you kind of live between life and death, because you either, I heard stories about patients who kind of started to get prepared, like, you know, farmers who kind of think about whom am I gonna kind of give my livelihood, like, who's gonna inherit my farm after I'm gone if I don't receive a liver. And you have at the same time have to prepare for death whilst you also prepare for a continuation of your life. And I don't know how much people who are in this period of time could actually benefit from, oh yeah, your waiting serves a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a certain, yeah, cynicism to it that kind of doesn't fully grasp the existential pressure and also dread, anxiety, hope that comes with it. They might, maybe some might, but it's also like, who am I as a researcher to tell people that their waiting also serves a purpose?
Yeah.
Because as there are not enough organs available, their waiting might also be very, yeah, there's a dead end to it in the, literally. And because you mentioned like the benefit of waiting list, I think what waiting list in itself, by itself, they don't serve a, do they serve a purpose for patients? They, for me, became really kind of interesting or inspiring to think about, because waiting lists serve as a kind of narrative, an idea, a hope, a kind of, it's a trope that pops up. The wait list. Are you on the wait list? How far up are you on the wait list? How many points on the wait list do I have? And if you're looking closer, there's not really a wait list there. So I imagined a list, really, like of people being listed, and depending on their, yeah, their the severity of the condition, the urgency, they receive a transplant or they have to wait a bit longer. What there actually is like an algorithm, the kind of, as soon as an organ becomes available, the organ is allocated to potential patients. And it's not so much that the list serves the patients, but the list becomes a very fleeting thing for one particular organ that is kind of the basis and the starting point of very temporal lists that appear depending on blood group, size of an organ, urgency of patients, and so on. So a very complex allocation system that lies behind the idea of a wait list as a very tangible and material object.
And then I was wondering a bit more about, so I only know about the UK context in terms of organ donation and how we've now moved to a kind of an opt-out process. And I was wondering if that would presumably speed up the waiting time, and then maybe therefore some of these factors. I don't know how relevant something like an opt-out system would be to that.
Those are always the hopes. And I am very hesitant to attribute a lot of influence that just the change of a legal framework has on these dynamics. We had the same discussion in Germany, where I conducted my research, where after a long period of advertisement by the health minister and kind of from trying to really shape the public debate in a way that they are for also like a shift from an opt-in to an opt-out system, because Germany suffers severely, have really low numbers of organ donors. But they, yeah, it's not, it was not so successful. So it was a failed attempt by the health minister there. And in Switzerland, where I'm located currently, there has been also a debate about exactly that last year, and like a public referendum where the public was in favor of changing from an opt-in to an opt-out system. And what was also interesting was that like Ethics Commission, the National Ethics Commission, was very prominently positioning itself against that shift, because they, on a basis of the individual body is individual property and shouldn't be made state property, and what might follow. So it was like, oh my god, if we start with that. While other countries have that opt-out system, and not the end of the world if you want to put it like that. But what is really important for me to say is that a change in system or in legal framework is not, won't have the effect that a lot of legal scholars or politicians wish it to be or present it to be, because what you need for an organ donation system to function is, on the one hand, relatives, nonetheless relatives and family members, a public that kind of supports the system. And very importantly, you need clinical staff. You need nurses in intensive care units who are trained in, on the one hand, identifying potential organ donors, being able to communicate with family members about that issue. And if you don't have the kind of system on the ground that is working, and medical clinical staff, nursing staff who are kind of standing behind organ donation and also kind of trained and have the time and the kind of feel that they're contributing also to a system that is worth contributing to, then the legal framework doesn't do anything. So I think it's one piece in a puzzle, or one piece in a mosaic if you want, but it's not the answer to the low number of organ donors. I think the answer to that, or like what is needed, is you have to address different players. And if you have clinics, and you have that in the UK, you have that all over Europe and all over the world, I guess, you have staffing shortages, you have clinics that don't allocate time for these things, I would say, also time to also have conversations, to educate nurses, because there's also, even if you're like working in an intensive care unit, or if you're educated, there's certain myths about organ donation and brain death that you have to educate nurses on and medical staff. So they are backing the system of organ donation. I think that was one of the what surprised me during my research in Germany, when they kind of looked at where are the kind of hindering factors, or what kind of explains a drop also in organ donations. It's not just the public perception. It is the perception of medical professionals, of nursing staff, who are critical of the practice itself. And if you don't have their, like if they don't back the system, if you don't have their support,
because they're the faces of it, right? Like the system is only what they explain it to be.
And if you don't have people trained to identify organ donors, if you don't have people who are able to have these really, really difficult conversations with family members, then you won't have donor organs. So
I think that's probably gone some way to answering my next question, but it was mainly, what do you think would be the one thing that you would want the public and practitioners to take away from your research? That's a big question.
I think, yeah, one thing would be that I mean, as an anthropologist, I always one of my answers is always like, it's more complex, but also like looking at organ donation at this very moment is that it is more complex than just also like signing a paper and signing, either opting in or opting out. Even that does not mean that you're already like an, for sure become an organ donor. There's so many factors involved, and that, I think one of the things I always found striking, how the chances that you might be in need of an organ, a donor organ, are way higher than the chances that you might become an organ donor. So thinking about that and how, yeah, something like waiting might serve a purpose, and is also might be an important period of time that, yeah, is needed for patients to prepare for the surgery to come and the life-changing medical intervention that they're undergoing. And I think one of, yeah, maybe one of the things I wanna communicate is that also transplant is not an end goal. So receiving a transplant is not the answer to all of your imaginations and hopes of then living a very healthy life. So you kind of switch and swap one chronic disease with another one. You extend your life, but also at certain costs. And what I would like to see in the like medical system in general is more, yeah, maybe more critical stance towards what they're doing in very straightforward framing transplant as the desired goal. So the discourse is very much not giving space to an assessment, a critical one, like, do I actually want a transplant? What are the benefits? What are the costs? What, like, is there an alternative? And not receiving a transplant is not seen as an alternative by biomedical, by the biomedical system, I would say. And so, yeah, giving a little bit of space to also reflecting on what kind of intervention is put forward as a must and a desirable goal.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And then looking to the future, so how does your current research relate to this area?
So my current research is on the one hand on palliative care. It's also getting more into questions of tinkering, improvisation, also like gender medicine, also staffing shortages and how recruitment practices shape the clinic as a space of labor. So I've various strands that I kind of try to follow at the moment. And my current research on palliative care is something that followed my research on liver transplant. And what I see like a parallels that there are is how waiting also at the end of life becomes a very uncertain period, because even in the context of end of life care, we tend to wish to get an answer about how many days, months, years do I have, do I get? Mm-hmm. And the humility you experience and feel when you see how even the most experienced medical professionals and experts in their field will say, you never know how long people have. you are, like, to be, to assume that you know is a sign of your lack of expertise, actually. And yes, so waiting for kind of death, dying, becomes another aspect that in my research that I kind of follow, that yeah, is relevant and connected to the stuff I've been doing during my research on liver transplants.
Can't wait to see it. Thank you so much, Julia. This has been such an interesting conversation. And yeah, I feel like I've come away with a lot more of an understanding of not only the kind of legal framework and how that works, but also like the practical aspects of it. And it's very personal and very human. So yeah, thank you so much for giving your time to talk to us today.
Thank you for your time and the invitation.